This is the takeaway for Thursday, December 21st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. It was the scene on the South Lawn yesterday. Republicans lined up on the South Portico of the White House to celebrate with President Trump a giant tax cut and the first tax overhaul in three decades. Meanwhile, back on Capitol Hill, Democrats had just let another legislative priority slip away, at least for now.
We feel very strongly that DACA must pass and pass by December 31st.
We must keep our word and our promise to them.
These are young people who study, who work, who live next door to us every single day.
We must pass the Bipartisan Dream Act now.
We have votes. I have no question that if we put the bill on the floor, it would win.
We think we're going to have a good number of our Republican colleagues join us. And so I am very optimistic that it will pass.
The Democrats, as you heard, have pledged for months there would be no government spending deal this Christmas unless a fix to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program went along with it. To put it plainly, the Dems said, deal with DACA, Republicans, or you've just bought yourself a government shutdown. Well, that was then. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said on Tuesday this week the government will be funded, at least until mid-January, even though DACA still hangs out there unresolved.
Is DACA on the table?
Senator Schumer and I have already discussed this. No, we'll not be doing DACA this week. That's for a matter to be discussed next year. The president's given us till March to address that issue. We have plenty of time.
Plenty of time, says the Republican leader. But is that how 700 DACA recipients in this country feel? Congressman Luis Gutierrez is a Democrat. He represents the 4th District in Illinois. Congressman, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the invite.
Congressman, your reaction to the Democratic leadership in Congress backing off here, at least before this next spending deadline?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty proud of the Democrats in the House. Seems we're going to stick together today. Remember, this is all dependent on one thing, and that is Republicans are the majority. They're 240 weak, strong in the House of Representatives. And they need 218 votes. If they present a Republican budget, a Republican CR, and it doesn't include our priorities, our values, then they need to find the votes. And if they find them, then they're going to approve it. I think it's our responsibility to stand up and say, we're not going to work with you. We're not going to collaborate with you unless it includes a clean fix and a Dream Act. In the Senate, it's another issue. And that's where I don't see the kind of firmness and commitment. And I hope that the minority leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, stands up for those dreamers. They visited him in his office. Because here's, in essence, my point. You know, you cannot say you love them and then put them on the stage at the 2012 Democratic Convention so that you can go out to the communities of voters in America and see, look what good people we are, what good public policy we are, and then not fight with them with the same kind of integrity and the same kind of importance. And they're just not doing that, I think.
So, Congressman, lots of advocacy groups are looking for the fix here. They're putting the pressure on, and you're referring to it. A spending deal today probably only goes a few weeks. Are you convinced that Democrats will have the leverage in mid-January for some kind of DACA fix, that they'll be able to push down on Republicans and get this deal done then? Because that seems to be the plan now.
Here's the essence of it, right? We're the minority party, and we've got to use our leverage. So what's our leverage? If you need our votes, if you need Democratic votes, then it's got to be something that's reflective of our values. But they want to celebrate Christmas and race home for the Christmas season and leave millions of kids without health care.
But what about after Christmas, Congressman? Because it looks like there's going to be another showdown, I don't know, maybe around January 19th or 20th when this current spending deal expires.
But here's my point. We can do it now. We can say, look, if the government is such a government that is treating people badly and is abusing people and is not fulfilling its commitment as you see it, then you have a responsibility to say no to that government and to funding that government. And if the senators join Republicans, Democratic senators, join Republican senators in the Senate, then you're not fulfilling your commitment. Then what you said is you can turn your back on a constituent group. And, you know, I wouldn't turn my back on women. I wouldn't turn my back on gay people. I just wouldn't turn my back on the environment, just like I wouldn't turn my back on these immigrant youth.
Congressman, you seem to be sending a message to Democrats everywhere who largely have Latino voters on their side, that if they don't come through here, they're putting a core constituency at risk.
Look, I want to make it very, very clear. In this last election, there was one really, really big lie after another. And one of them was that somehow 30% of the Latinos voted for Donald Trump. Well, guess what? In the 4th congressional district that I represent, he got 10% of the vote, and you can go and look it up. My congressional district is not uniformly Latino. It's 73% Latino, but it is a majority Latino district, and you can see how people voted. And I'm going to tell you something. I want to make sure the American public understand this is a priority for us. These kids, these youth that have come forward, signed up, given their names, their addresses, gone through a background check, and are now vulnerable to this mass deportation policy of this president. We asked them to sign up, and now it's our responsibility to protect them. And the way to protect them, if that means that we deny our votes and the government shuts down, that's on the Republicans. They're the majority party in the House and the Senate. Our responsibility is to advance an agenda of justice and of fairness and of priorities. And I got to tell you, whether you're Hispanic or not Hispanic, whether you're immigrant or born here, you know those kids deserve a pathway forward.
And Congressman, in January, do you think enough of your Democratic colleagues, let's say probably in the Senate, I think you're right about that, are going to be willing to go to the mat the way you are for a government shutdown?
They had better, or they have to understand one thing. There will be a lot of disillusionment and a lot of anger at the Democratic Party. I know we're the party in the minority, but if we have the leverage, if you have the leverage to stop something bad from happening and you don't do it, then you're an accomplice of those that are taking bad and evil actions against the American people.
Congressman Luis Gutierrez, Democrat from Illinois' 4th District. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, yesterday we brought you an update in the topsy-turvy story of elections for Virginia's House of Delegates. Things just got weirder. Yesterday, the news was that the House of Delegates was now tied 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats after a Democrat won her race by one single vote. Well, now that single vote is gone, and you won't believe what's going to happen next. Michael Pope with Virginia Public Radio is here. Michael, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Michael, my head is spinning. What's going on in Richmond? What's going on down there? What's the latest?
Well, there was a recount this week in Newport News that had this surprise result that you were just talking about. The result of the recount was that the Democrat in the race had a one-vote margin of victory. But things weren't over yet because the race still had to be certified by a three-judge panel. So the three-judge panel met yesterday and heard about this ballot that had been called into question. After that one vote margin of victory, and everybody in the world was talking about this race that was decided by one vote, there was a Republican official who had taken part in the recount who had concerns about a ballot that had been cast aside during the recount that was confusing, which is why it was set aside. And essentially what happened with this ballot is that the circles for the Democrat and the Republican in this race were both filled out, but then there was a slash through the Democrat's name. And the reason this was confusing, for many reasons, but if you look at that same ballot for the governor's race, one of the bubbles had been filled in, and there was an X mark through that name. So, very confusing ballot. That's why it was sort of cast aside during the recount. But then, yesterday, the judges were asked to take yet another look at this questionable ballot, which they did. And after deliberating for about 2 hours, they determined that this ballot should have been counted for the Republican. So, they added it to the vote totals. So after adding that one vote for the Republican, the race was tied at 11,608 votes for the Democrat, 11,608 votes for the Republican.
Yet another story in American elections of voter intent. So a dead tie in this race, Michael Pope. The makeup and control over the House of Delegates hangs in the balance because when everyone thought the Democrat was going to win, it was going to be 50-50. Now you have a tie in this race. What happens in the event of a tie? What's next?
This is not unheard of. Ties actually happen in elections every now and then. And so the state law is that it's determined by lot. In other words, randomly selected. And so over the years, this has been done a number of ways. In Williamsburg, where they love all their colonial history, they actually draw names out of a tricorn hat. Back in 1971, there was a tie for a House of Delegates race, and so the State Board of Elections borrowed a ornate silver cup from the Executive Mansion and drew it out of the ornate silver cup. You know, when the State Board of Elections actually determines ballot order, they have a random selection process where they draw names out of a bowl. So they're actually used to the whole process of randomly selecting names to determine the order of the ballot, and they're going to use that same process for this, but it's not over yet because the loser in that can request a second recount. And that's where the ship seems to be headed right now.
It definitely does, because even though it's kind of a fun parlor game trying to figure out how Virginia is going to decide who wins this race, flip a coin, take him out of a bowl, even people were joking about shucking a Chesapeake Bay oyster and see where the pearl is. Regardless of how they do this, power in Richmond hangs in the balance here. I mean, this will determine how Republicans and Democrats share power in the House of Delegates or who really controls it.
Absolutely. So what's at stake here is the balance here, 51 Republicans, 49 Democrats, or 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats. And so that really determines who the Speaker of the House is, how the committees are set up, who is in control. You know, if it's the Republicans, obviously they'll elect their Speaker, even with a one-vote margin. If it's 50-50, the Democrats and Republicans will be forced into a power-sharing situation, which actually happened in the late 90s. And so all the committees had even numbers of Democrats and Republicans, and they actually had co-chairs. So instead of having one chairman for a committee, they actually had a Democratic chair and a Republican chair. Very few people were happy with that situation. It was very frustrating for everybody. So, you know, both sides here are actually obviously looking to rule the House, but they're also preparing for a very difficult and frustrating power-sharing situation if they need to go there.
All of a sudden, America is watching one race in Virginia for a House of Delegates seat, and I don't think this is the last day that we're going to be doing it. Michael Pope with Virginia Public Radio. Michael, I'm glad we have you for this. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
For 9 months, beginning last October, Iraqi soldiers and an American-led coalition carried out a huge assault on the city of Mosul. It was all part of an effort to take back the Iraqi city from ISIS. That mission was achieved in July, but only recently has the huge human cost of the operation become known. A new investigation from the Associated Press finds the number of civilian deaths in that campaign for Mosul was much, much higher than previously reported, at least 11,000. Lori Hinnant was one of the reporters on that investigation. She's an international security correspondent with the AP. And Chris Woods is director of Air Wars. They're a UK-based nonprofit that tracks civilian casualties caused by international military actions. It helped out with the AP story.
Our own analysis made clear that thousands of civilians had died at Mosul. I think the challenge that we had is in so many of the cases we were looking at, we simply couldn't determine who had killed or injured those civilians. It may have been coalition fire, it may have been Iraqi fire, it may have been ISIS attacks, it may actually have been a combination of all three of those. So our own baseline numbers prior to this AP investigation of civilians harmed by the US-led coalition, for example, were just over 1,000 deaths. I think the work that AP has put in and in trying to understand much better where those civilians were harmed and how, we probably will be raising that estimate now.
Lori, the bottom line of your story is something on the order of 11,000 civilian deaths. This is a casualty rate that you say is nearly 10 times higher than previously reported. Where did the old numbers come from, and why such a huge discrepancy now?
The old number came from the Iraqi prime minister, who had previously told AP that 1,250 people had been killed, 1,250 civilians had been killed in the fight to free Mosul from Islamic State. That was a figure that he had given us in, I think, October. And what we ended up doing is we, over the last 4 months, we've been going through the list of reports, both from Air Wars, from Iraq Body Count. We've gone through the report from Amnesty International, cross-referenced all of them to find reports in which there are more than one source. And then we went to the morgue, and it turns out that no one had actually gone to the morgue before. And we received multiple lists that totaled between 9 and 11,000 civilians, depending on how you're counting and who you're counting. We already discarded names that were obviously those of Islamic State fighters who'd been killed. And we discarded those people who had been killed who were brought in from elsewhere, because we concluded that they hadn't been killed in the Mosul operation. And what we ended up with in comparing both sets of lists was a range between 9 and 11,000.
And Lori, can you break down how those civilians died in the campaign for Mosul?
It's a little hard to break down specifically how they died. The morgue records plus the cross-referenced databases indicate that at least a third of them were from airstrikes, artillery fire, or mortar from the Iraqi or coalition forces. Around a third is clearly from Islamic State fighters. Those include people who were shot trying to escape, people who were blown up in suicide attacks, executions that were taking place really by the dozens, particularly in the beginning of the operation. And the last third, as Chris just said, it's really hard to tell which side. It was particularly as the fight moved to West Mosul, you ended up with civilians very much being caught in between airstrikes, mortars, and Islamic State explosives.
Chris, the incentive of a politician to lowball the numbers, that's pretty easy to understand. I just wonder if there's a way to put this devastating result into some context, similar urban warfare that we've seen in the recent past.
It had always been anticipated that we'd see the highest number of civilian casualties during this last stage of the war against so-called Islamic State, with the assaults on both Mosul and Raqqa in Syria. I do think, however, there are questions here about quite how many civilians died. Why was the humanitarian corridor closed? Why was it the case that civilians were no longer able to escape Mosul? Why was the bombing of Mosul by the coalition at such an intense rate? The coalition tells us that they alone dropped 29,000 munitions on Mosul, knowing that there were tens and tens of thousands of civilians trapped there. And we now know that at least 10,000 civilians died overall in that operation. The coalition response to this is to say, well, this was the most precise war in history. If we hadn't gone in and done this, you know, many more civilians would have died. Both of those things can be true, but we could still end up at this point with so many dead civilians. And I think the coalition needs to be giving much clearer answers. Firstly, about why so many died and whether fewer could have died. And secondly, why its own investigations into Mosul just aren't happening right now. There's not enough coming from the U.S. and its allies on this.
Lori, can you conclude based on this reporting or other reporting during the invasion of Mosul that the United States and its coalition partners did not do enough to address civilian casualties, did not do enough to make sure escape routes were open, or even to avoid targeting civilians as they went after ISIS?
Well, the United States coalition, the United States-led coalition told us that any civilian casualties are squarely on the shoulders of Islamic State because they're the ones that were herding hundreds of civilians into West Mosul, essentially to try and deter airstrikes. And so they were literally shunting hundreds of civilians from place to place. The problem lies in the requirement for proportionality, and the coalition and the Iraqi forces say that they felt like they had little choice in the matter.
And Chris, there has been some indication that the numbers that you and the AP have found could go much higher because not all of the people by any stretch are in morgues around Mosul. They may be in graves around the city.
Well, that's right. And also, I think one of the unknowns here is how many family members of ISIS fighters also died in the last stages of the fighting. And many of those bodies may not have been recovered. And even if they are, may never be claimed. So this is why, you know, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, other international NGOs have been calling for a proper inquiry now that the fight for Mosul is over into what went right during that battle and what went wrong.
Chris Woods, director of Air Wars. Chris, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Laurie Hinnant with the Associated Press, an international security correspondent. Laurie, thank you.
Thanks.
The European Union's highest court came down hard on Uber this week. It ruled that the app-based ride-hailing service should be regulated like any other taxi provider across the European Union. Now, Uber has fought for a long time to be treated by governments like a digital platform only, just an app that connects people who like to drive to people who need rides. And that identity, just an app, lets Uber avoid most of the responsibilities and liabilities and regulations of a traditional taxi or transportation business. Well, no longer, at least not in the EU. Meanwhile, Uber has seen similar fights all across America. Arun Sundarajan is an expert on that kind of model and these fights that are going on with ride sharing. Arun, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Arun, let's talk about this EU ruling first. What did the EU say to Uber, and what does it mean for drivers and for riders there?
So this was an anticipated ruling from the EU. In deciding whether Uber was a digital platform or a transportation service, they came down on the side that Uber is a transportation service, just like a traditional taxi service or a black car service. What this means is that all Uber drivers will have to be professional drivers. In all likelihood, Uber's relationship with its drivers will have to change from contractors to them being full-time employees. And so it dramatically changes Uber's cost structure if it wants to operate in different European cities.
If Uber wants to operate in Paris or Utrecht, you can no longer just say, hey, person with a Toyota and an app, drive and get some money. You have to treat them like a person with a job, with benefits and a pension and everything else.
I think the specifics of exactly how Uber drivers need to be treated are going to vary city to city. Like in the United States, across Europe, transportation is regulated at the local level. But it certainly sort of raises the bar for Uber because it's a business that has tried to bring in sort of casual labor to shore up supply shortages, like, you know, during rush hours. It's tried a wide variety of UberX-like services in many European cities, and these have already been shut down. What worries me more about this decision is that I think Uber is going to find a way around it. They've got the scale, they've got the demand, they've got the financial resources. For a smaller startup that's trying to enter a new European city, the barriers have just become a lot higher.
So it gets tougher for smaller players. But does this mean in the bottom line that the virtues of the gig economy, the sort of the cheap labor that was available in the Uber model, is not going to be allowed in Europe, at least not in the way that, that Uber had hoped?
Well, I don't think that it's going to be allowed for transportation services. I believe that this ruling will spill over to other gig economy or on-demand services like delivery on demand, hiring people through an app. So it's certainly going to place a lot of barriers on platforms that offer these kinds of services and are currently using contract labor.
So let's come back to the United States then, because Uber, and it's just one service, although it's the biggest, the most high profile, it's been going into city after city, community after community in the United States. And it seems like every time they do, they wind up disrupting, maybe a good thing, but they wind up in a confrontation of some kind, either with local transportation services, which makes sense, or with the local economy. Give us a couple of examples of how Uber's been sort of confronting the different cities that it's gone into.
I think that every city that Uber has entered in the United States has led to some kind of confrontation early on. One of the early success stories was actually New York City. There was early confrontation, a ban back in 2012, but they very quickly came to agreement with the Taxi and Limousine Commission and found that middle ground between transportation service and digital platform. The city came up with regulations tailored for Uber. Uber complied with them. This contrasts with, say, Oregon, except for Portland. Uber is banned across the state of Oregon right now because they haven't been able to find that middle ground. I think that the service itself poses challenges because it flies in the face of what we're used to. But I think Uber's personality in the past as a pugilist rather than as a pacifier has also been partly responsible for the level of regulatory confrontation that we've seen them engaged in.
Now, Uber has relished this confrontation. I live in Washington, D.C. Certainly, there was a high-profile confrontation that Uber seemed to be enjoying when they came to town.
That was certainly Uber's personality in the past. I've seen a dramatic change in that over the last few weeks that their new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, has taken over, where he's trying to reposition Uber as a sort of a compliant partner who is worthy of the public trust rather than a disruptive Silicon Valley platform that breaks all the rules.
And this decision in the EU, is it likely to solidify that new attitude? I mean, there's a danger here maybe that big American cities and their city councils may take the cue from the European Union and say, no, 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 we want you to be a taxi company.
Well, I'm sure that there will be some thinking in municipal governments in the United States sort of reflecting on the structures that they've come up with. But labor law in the U.S. is fundamentally different from labor law in the European Union. We're far more open to the independent contractor model here than cities in the European Union are. And so while I expect some reflection, I think we should also recognize that many American cities have spent many years coming up with the right regulatory structure that recognizes this new middle ground that exists between a hands-off digital platform that is unregulated and the traditional sort of taxi service with full-time employees.
And we're going to spend a lot of time over the next 2, 5, 10 years talking about this revolution in labor. This gig economy, it's not going away. This EU decision and the sort of patchwork model we have in the United States, what does this tell you about the future of this new way of working? Or is it too early to tell?
You know, we've gotten used to one model of work arrangement, people being full-time employees for a large employer. This was the dominant model in the 20th century in the West, in Western Europe, Japan, the United States. We're seeing a pretty dramatic shift away towards non-employment work arrangements. The gig economy, independent contractor arrangements are one such example. But I think it highlights the continued need to start to decouple the social safety net from the status of full-time employment and allow people who choose alternative work arrangements, people who run their own businesses, people who are independent contractors, people who are freelancers, from getting the benefits, the stability, the protection, the paid vacations that are currently the unique sort of privilege of full-time employees.
Well, we're a long way from that in this country. We've reported on this show that 180 million Americans still get their health insurance through work. So it's going to be a long time before that transformation. Arun Sundarrajan, thanks for being here. You getting an Uber out of here?
I'm getting a Juno, actually.
Arun Sundarrajan of NYU is leaving our studios in a Juno, small competitor to Uber, while Uber fights it out in the EU and across America. Arun, thanks for being here.
And thank you for having me.
We have a couple of stories from Latin America now. First, Peru, where President Pablo Kuczynski is making a case in front of Congress today, trying to avoid impeachment. Let's go back a year. The U.S. government announced a plea deal with Brazilian construction giant Odebrecht. The company agreed to pay at least $3.5 billion to resolve what the Justice Department called the largest foreign bribery case in history. That deal revealed an extensive web of bribery and corruption across Latin America, including $29 million in payments to government officials in Peru, stretching over three presidencies. And that's where Pablo Kuczynski comes in. Mitra Taj is a Reuters correspondent in Lima. She says President Kuczynski has been defiant, even as evidence ties him to Odebrecht.
He denied for most of the year that he had any kind of a link to this company, but then some documents came out showing that he, in fact, had a company that once received payments from it, and a close business associate of his also had a company that once received payments from it. So the opposition says that they look very suspicious and appear to be, you know, bribes camouflaged as legitimate business dealings. He hasn't been accused of any crime, but the opposition is really seizing this moment to make him look like he's, you know, a corrupt lobbyist.
What kind of bribes are we talking about and how much money?
Well, the company hasn't said it bribed Kuczynski at all. It has admitted to having bribed politicians across Latin America. And it's working with prosecutors now to detail exactly who took the bribes and who didn't. So there's no indication that Kuczynski was one of the politicians that took any kind of a bribe, but it just doesn't look good for him to now be seen having links to this company after denying it before.
Well, if payments from Odebrecht to officials all across Latin America are a factor here, how wide does this go? How many countries? How many officials?
They've acknowledged bribing officials in, I believe, 9 or 10 countries in Latin America and a couple of countries in Africa as well. Obviously, Brazil is the place where this scandal has hit the hardest because that's where the company is from. But outside of Brazil, the company was really, really active in Peru. And there's now two ex-presidents who have been ensnared in the scandal. One is in jail. The other one is considered a fugitive. And there's also, you know, major leaders of opposition parties are also under investigation now.
And Mitra, you mentioned the long history of this in Peru. One former leader in jail, another on the run, Pablo Kuczynski potentially on the way out, and even their president from back in the 90s, Alberto Fujimori, he's in jail too behind human rights violations. This seems to be a troubling part of Peruvian political culture.
Yeah, definitely. Peruvians aren't proud of it. They do joke that they should build a prison just for ex-presidents. In fact, the two ex-presidents who are now behind bars are in the same prison. It's unclear where future ones might end up. But it really has sown this deep distrust of political leaders and of the established political class. And there's this sense that everybody's corrupt and everybody must go. And if there were new elections in Peru, which is now a possibility, that could bring in some political outsiders and maybe change things.
Is there an anti-corruption movement sweeping Latin America now? You said this is not just about Peru.
No, there is a graft scandal sweeping Latin America, and there are a lot of prosecutors doing a lot of work these days trying to figure out who was on the take in terms of the bribes from Odebrecht. And there are a lot of people that are very fed up and would like to see things change. But whether that translates into something kind of more meaningful and grassroots in terms of really holding political leaders up to higher standards and making sure that they don't take part in anything corrupt, I think remains to be seen still.
Mitra Taj with Reuters in Lima, Peru. Mitra, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses, from laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
We go to Venezuela now, where political instability and economic collapse have led to mass food insecurity. According to a survey by three of the top universities in Venezuela, 9.6 million people eat two or fewer meals per day, and 93% of the population can't afford all the food they need. Journalist Mariana Zuniga joins me from Caracas. Mariana, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a picture of the extent of this food crisis in Venezuela.
It's not weird to see in Venezuela many people scrapping or going through the garbage to find something to eat. For many years, the news from Venezuela were that they were saying that there was a huge scarcity of basic products. But now the main problem is not actually the scarcity, but the hyperinflation. The products, you can find many products on the shelves, even though some are missing. But people, most of them, can have access to those products because they are really, really expensive.
Well, Mariana, how are families responding to this crisis in food, even in cases where their own children might be going hungry?
With parents, it's really, really difficult, especially for parents who have babies right now. It is really difficult to find formula for babies because it's very scarce. And sometimes when you find it, you can find it in 600,000 bolivars. And that's actually two minimum wages. So for the poorest family, this is very difficult. Some parents are giving away their children to foster home because they can't feed them.
Mariana, is that a widespread phenomenon, parents giving their children away to foster homes?
Yeah, there are some parents that can't feed their children and they can't buy enough food, especially those who have five or six children at home. So some of them are actually giving them to organizations and to foster homes for them to take care of their children. And they are paying visits to them on the weekends just because it's impossible for them economically to have them at home. Also, some women that they can breastfeed their children, they are preparing bottles with the water that they use to cook rice or pasta. But that's not enough to feed a baby. So those are the kind of tragic images that we're seeing now in Venezuela, especially for those who have children and that belong to the poorer classes.
What's been the government's response to all this? People must be making demands on officials if there's not enough food.
Yes. The problem with the government response is that they don't acknowledge that there's a humanitarian crisis in the government. They don't release data because if they do, they will have to acknowledge this crisis. And they are not accepting international aid because they see this aid as some kind of intervention. The government thinks that all these economic crises that the Venezuelan is living is due to an economic war against the economy and against the Venezuelan government. And now, even though the crisis exists since 2014, when the oil prices went down, the government is blaming the United States because of the sanctions that they imposed this year.
And if doctors who are seeing malnourished children speak out or report to the government, what happens?
Many doctors are afraid of speak out because, especially those who work in the public sector, because they are afraid of being fired. They think that they are more useful being at the hospital working for their patients than speaking out, because there are not many doctors left in Venezuela. As we know, there's a big exodus of Venezuelans, and doctors are part of those professionals that have left in recent years. So many are afraid to speak out. As an example, I could tell you that Venezuela didn't release data relating to health for maybe 3 years. And at the beginning of this year, the health minister, they released some data regarding maternal health and maternal mortality and child mortality as well. And also some data regarding this kind of disease that have disappeared for a long time, like diphtheria or tuberculosis, and that came back to Venezuela. And after that report was released, the Minister of Health, maybe 2 weeks later, she was fired. So that's an example to let you know how bad the consequences are for people who speak against the government or who give information that the government doesn't want people to know.
Mariana Zuniga, journalist in Caracas, Venezuela. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
He's been gone. Well, be 18 years in March.
You go from headed to medical school to heading to prison. It was almost incomprehensible.
It was hard. I wasn't here for a lot of stuff.
It is a weight lifted off your shoulders. And now he's going to be home and safe.
They granted it and they can't take it back. They can't take it away.
Still seems like a dream. Like I said, he's been turned down so many times.
It is going to be a ride.
President Obama decided to relook at your case and he granted you clemency today.
Back in February, we brought you the story of Aaron Glasscock. He'd just been released from prison in rural Manchester, Kentucky. Aaron served 18 years for a nonviolent drug offense. And then Aaron became one of nearly 2,000 Americans to receive clemency from President Obama. The Takeaway met Aaron on the day of his release back in February. He was heading to a transitional home in Louisville and on the cusp of a new life. He was 40 years old and starting all over again.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Get the back.
Back?
Yep. You sure? You want him in the back or? I want him in the back with me.
Okay. Wow.
It's now been 9 months since Aaron's release. Takeaway producer Dana Roberson went down to Kentucky last month to meet with Aaron and his mom, Pigeon, to find out how they've been coping in his first months of freedom.
It's a cold and windy November day in Louisville, Kentucky. Thanksgiving is still a week away, but the airwaves are already filled with holiday tunes.
Got
Light 106.9, Louisville's original Christmas music station.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock.
On my way to Aaron's aunt's house, where Aaron has been staying, I passed the transitional facility where he was placed after his release from prison 9 months ago. On that day, back in February, Aaron only had a few hours to make the 170-mile drive to the halfway house. And after 18 years in prison, he had just minutes to gather with his family on the sidewalk in front before he was sent inside.
I have one question.
Uh-oh, yes. One question.
Do you know how to dab?
No,
it's a new cool thing.
All right, let's
do it. It is a new cool thing. Okay, so you do this.
Okay.
We can walk. We're going to walk him to the door. He said we can drop him off. We're going to drop him off at the door.
For Aaron, that day was a blur.
I was just super excited to be able to get out, you know, from Manchester. And I already had it in my mind what I was going to the halfway house. So just, you know, from years of visits to see mom and family and friends, they leave. So you sort of get used to it. I'm used to having to go back in.
Aaron was sentenced to at least 2 months in a halfway house and an additional 5 years of probation. Aaron's mom, Pigeon, was used to visiting her son when he was in prison, driving 2 hours each way every week. But when it got to the halfway house, it felt harder.
Oh my goodness, we left him there and that was hard, but he was able to get to a phone later on and he called and let me know that he was okay.
Maybe okay, but those first few hours didn't exactly go smoothly.
They didn't give him a tour of the place and tell him where anything was. He went out to find a restroom. One of the other inmates came to find him because he had gone in the women's. That was the only one he saw. And I thought, you know, that was really kind of bad, leave you in a room and not show you where a bathroom was. But, you know, that's my opinion.
I mean, they gave me a tour after I'd already went to the wrong bathroom. So, a little late, but they did, you know, I did finally get the tour.
Aaron's stay at the halfway house was a blink of an eye compared to the nearly 20 years he spent in prison. But in Pigeon's estimation, this was a worse experience.
His parole officer, he told me before that his hardest time of 18 years would be in that halfway house. And I'll have to agree with him.
Maybe 2 weeks before I got out, they finally started letting guys have smartphones. Which actually, I mean, ultimately benefited them because they can put, as a part of it, they put like a tracking thing on there. So whenever you get to your location or whatever, you call in, but you had the camera on, almost like FaceTime, I guess. And it would see where you're at. I mean, and I was thankful for, you know, that it was only 2 months after being there for a little bit. So just you're just so restricted. It's like you're on the verge of freedom, but you're not.
In a lot of ways, there was less freedom. There was no outside, and you had to have a pass to go to the barber shop, to go shopping. And if there's family, they don't let the family in enough. There's not enough, I don't know how you put it, guidance and caring.
I can see it from both sides. I mean, I can understand, you know, family's frustration, my mom's frustration of seeing it, but I've also, because I've had to deal with it, you know, every step of the way and see the ones that really, you know, tried to help, or they've tried to help and people have taken advantage of it, and then it makes them bitter. So, I mean, I've seen it both ways.
From Pigeon's perspective, his comings and goings with little to no guidance worried her.
They are so green. They can get in a bad situation fast. And that's why it was the hardest time, is because knowing that I couldn't be here when they would let him out like that. He was on his own, and we couldn't do anything about it.
For Aaron, it was different.
You know, I wasn't as much worried about where I was at, because I've been to places that are just as rough. But for me, it was being worried about making sure I made it back on time so that I wouldn't get in trouble. That was where all my anxiety came from, was, okay, well, if I don't make it back, then they're going to send me, you know, back to prison, and then what? I'd always, you know, I'm from a small town, so we don't have public transportation. So I didn't know exactly, you know, how it worked. I didn't have a schedule. So for me, it was, you know, mostly anxious about, okay, well, I gotta be there at this time.
Were you ever late?
No. I was always way early, just because I was afraid to be late. I didn't, you know.
Pigeon says she was grateful to see him on the outside, but it's been baby steps for Aaron in feeling comfortable with his newfound freedom.
He got to come out for a little bit, you know, like for visits and when we had to take him shopping. It was hard at times watching him because you know that they're struggling, and I know he got frustrated. I could tell it. It was really different, and you could tell.
Tomorrow, out of the halfway house, Aaron adjusts to life without restrictions, a new job, and a chance to catch up on some of the little things in life that he's missed.
Oh, you're getting both tires off the ground, so you're coming up off the ground.
I'm Dana Roberson for The Takeaway.
You can hear more of our series following Aaron Glasscock. That's on our website at thetakeaway.org/lifeafterprison. And that's our show today. We always want to hear from you, so give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the shortest day of the year. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.